Welcome to the Daily Ben Show, offering insightful and thought-provoking news commentary and analysis from a classically liberal centrist perspective. The show is brought to you by the Institute of Race Relations. Tune in at 4:30 every Monday to Thursday for engaging discussions from our team of analysts and researchers that you won't find anywhere else.
Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to the Daily Friend Show. I'm your host, Nicholas Lorimer, and I'm joined today by Mr. Herman Pretorius. Herman, how has your week and your weekend been?
It has been fascinating, I think, as we were chatting just before recording. It has been a very, very interesting week where the victimhood roles almost seem to reverse, and it's just been a crazy time. And then this morning, I've had a couple of Twitter spats with Phumzile van Dam, so my week is off to a good start.
And Mr. Gabriel Krauser. Gabriel, how are things going?
Yeah, not bad. Fascinating times, Chinese curse, all that. Very good.
Yes, I had a very relaxing weekend, so I feel a little bit out of whack with the rest of the universe, the way that everyone seems to be running around. Anyway, let's get into one of the main causes of all of this excitement and frustration, which is, of course, the U.S. election. Now, we've talked about it a lot last week, but my first question, I think, to you, Herman, is, well, there's three questions. Who won? Was there fraud? And what's next for America?
Well, it depends on who you ask. It depends on who you ask, and it depends on who you ask to answer your three questions, you know, very, very succinctly. But if you are going to push me beyond, you know, that level of insight that I'm very proud of, is I think Joe Biden has won. I think there's a general acceptance happening that there's no realistic way for Donald Trump to really make up any of his any of the ground that he is behind in the Electoral College, especially with Pennsylvania, you know, and Arizona and Nevada essentially being called for Biden, and then Georgia also not looking too good for Trump. But I'm clinging to the hope that he might eke out a win there, because then that would make my prediction absolutely spot on in terms of states and Electoral College votes. But so who is one seems to be Joe Biden. All the media, former President George Bush, former Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice from the Republican side. I mean, there's been this general congratulations of well done, Joe Biden. Now, on the question of was there fraud, and you know, in fact, to quote the Don Trump, was there major fraud? I would have to say that the weight of the evidence at this point says no. If it's a general good rule, not just of legal argument, legal cases, but just of logic, is if someone's going to make a claim, they must be able to back up that claim. And once they have provided some backing up to that claim, those backing up substantiation things must be weighed up and seen if they amount to anything. And everything that we've seen so far from the side that claims the election was fraudulent really does either boil down to hearsay, conjecture, or a very selective representation of data. People might have heard that there are some statistical anomalies about the first digit being this and that. I can't remember exactly, but if you look at the data and you look a bit below, then you see that the people there seems to have taken the data representation directly from a textbook on how to lie with statistics, because it really just kind of seems to conveniently choose the calibration of the graph. So hearsay, conjecture, possible anomalies, but nothing really much. And I must say that the burden of proof is quite substantial. Not only do you have to prove that they were anomalies, you have to prove that those anomalies are significant in the results, and that similar anomalies haven't been, you know, part of previous election cycles. And I think if you consider what the weight of that burden of proof is. I just don't think we are at the point to say that the election was stolen, nor do I think it likely, but it's possible that we will get there. Next question, what forward? What now going forward? John Roberts, the Chief Justice of the Supreme Court, will likely within the next few weeks find himself listening to a case or find his court listening to a case. And if there's one thing that we've learned from John Roberts is that he is a center-right pragmatist when it comes to at least, you know, balancing his judicial philosophy, which would in the American context fall to the right, you know, some form of originalism, text-boundism, limited judicial activism from the bench. And then he's also quite politically astute, where he makes judgments one way or the other, often to maintain political stability and not to upset the apple cart. I think we saw that with his judgment in or the court's judgment and his vote in the Obamacare case all those years ago. And I think that if the Supreme Court were to be faced with a challenge as to the results of the election, I'm pretty confident that we will end up in a situation where the Supreme Court does not want to upset the apple cart, John Roberts especially, and we're still likely continuing to the inauguration of Joe Biden as the 46th president of the USA on the 20th of January, 2021.
Okay, so Gabriel, three main questions to you. Firstly, anything to add on the fraud point? Secondly, what do you make of Trump's claims about fraud? How do you think this, what do you think the effect of this is going to be? And third, what do you make of Joe Biden's victory speech?
So just a point to add on fraud. This feels like a movie we've seen before. In 2016, there was a claim coming from the Democrat side that the election was stolen because Russians interfered in the public square. That was true. Russians did interfere in the public square, and all the intelligence agencies said so from the beginning. But there is a difference between interference, as in you've tried to do something, and interference, as in you've successfully changed the outcome. All the evidence very solidly shows that the Russians did interfere in one sense, the sense of trying, and did not interfere in this other sense. They didn't actually make a difference. The same thing is happening with fraud. There definitely was fraud in this election. There can be no doubt about that. There's fraud in every election. The question is, was this change the outcome? Was there significant fraud? Was there, as the president says, major fraud? And I just sort of urge everyone to beware of the ways that people on both sides use that homonymy, the one word having two meanings, fraud meaning this thing was stolen, it would have had a different outcome, versus fraud meaning, well, someone tried to do something, there was one double counted vote or something like that, but it didn't actually make a consequential difference. Just notice how people switch from one sense of the word to the other, either to support the case that there's definitely fraud and so the election was definitely stolen, or no, the election wasn't stolen, therefore there's no fraud at all. Both of those are sort of spurious syllogisms, sophistry. To be aware of. In terms of Donald Trump's comments right now, I think they are as distressing as could be. You know, one way to figure that is by imagining a slightly similar but different, but significantly different response. The president could have said, look, I will concede. Absolutely. Please let there be absolutely no doubt about that. I will concede just in case the American people voted me out. And it's looking like that happened, but I'm not going to go anywhere until my lawyers have had a chance to test the evidence and the recounts go through that have already been scheduled or that ought to be scheduled according to state regulations in various places. He could have said that. It would have sent a strong message that he's very suspicious of some anomalies. He's very suspicious of parts of the process, but that he respects the process more than his own ego. And he could have done that. It would have been almost exactly the same as what he's doing now. The only difference is now he's declaring himself to be the winner. And last week it was different. I remember being on a Daily French Show podcast where I'd said he declared himself to be the winner in North Carolina, and this is being used to say that he's declaring himself the winner overall. But he's shifted his language to be completely unambiguous, that he believes that he won the presidency, that it has been stolen, and that the process is not what's going to convince him one way or another. In fact, he's already made up his mind, he's made his judgment, and now the investigation will begin. And that's just back to front. And I think for people who liked President Trump, who looked at his achievements, who looked at his foreign policy breakthroughs in the Middle East, who saw the pivot against Beijing and the recalibration of trade, which was achieved after the trade war. Tariffs were starting to come down. China was coming to the table under a fairer regime. Same thing in Mexico, same thing with the EU, same thing with NATO. People who looked at those international and domestic achievements with the economy growing so well have always had this one bugbear of, like, you know, well, the president's effects generally on the economy and on realpolitik have been at least arguably very salutary. People will disagree, but there's a strong argument to be made that they are salutary. But the president's rhetoric has been divisive, destructive, alienating, insulting, and so on. And if only he could dial that back, and maybe it's not worth it for all of the toxic energy that he injects into the public square. I think those people who were sitting on the fence or who liked him and thought that his policy trumped his Twitter account in terms of what matters have to reevaluate the president's exit strategy here. Have to reevaluate their appraisal based on the president's exit strategy. And I think that's very disappointing. I think that he is going to besmirch, if he continues in this vein, he's going to besmirch his positive achievements and sort of keep fueling fire for the woke left and for the Antifa left, as well as for the sort of regressive right, strand of the right. And I don't think that serves anyone well. Nicholas, you did ask a third question.
Yes, I'll get to that in a second. I see Herman has a comment. Herman?
Yes. Yeah, I must say I think Gabriel is absolutely right on, and I want to pick up two points that very briefly. The first one is where Trump's position really in the credibility of the election results has been communication. There is nothing wrong with saying, as Gabriel suggests, I will accept the results of this election, but I have some concerns, and I will undoubtedly accept the outcome when those concerns, through due process of law, have been addressed, and American democracy, but not just American democracy, the American constitutional system can be shown to be above reproach. Until then, I ask everyone to remain calm. We're still, tempers are high, but we keep going on and we take it as Americans will. So the first thing, but then the communication is also a problem on his COVID-19 strategy. Because from what I can gather, and I might be wrong on this, but from what I can gather, Joe Biden's COVID-19 strategy is essentially Donald Trump and Mike Pence's COVID-19 strategy with a federal mask mandate. And so that was the communication of what they were doing that really stood in Trump's way of not being seen as this disaster on COVID-19. So I must say the last point that on this is what happens now. If Trump continues to play this irresponsibly, having set himself up for, a not really coherent strategy, but if he continues to undermine any possible chance that he might have of legitimately questioning the results of the election, the Republican Party will seek to cut him loose. Mitch McConnell will, as I've said before, become the de facto leader of the Republican Party. The political capital will flow to him, and strategic, ruthless man that he is, if he thinks it's in the best interest of the party to, in anticipation of the 2022 congressional elections, cut loose and end the bleeding that is the Trump blow-up, Mitch McConnell will not hesitate to do that in the interest of his caucus. So Trump must be very, very careful here not to assume that he still has the bully pulpit to the same extent that he had it a week ago.
Yeah, and in the short term, that comes down to Georgia. So all the Republicans, most people advertise that the Republicans are likely to hold the Senate, and that's going to result in a Joe Biden presidency without the Senate being in the same camp as the White House, which will weaken his hand somewhat, force him to negotiate more. If there's one thing that he has been able to do as vice president under Obama, it was reach across the aisle, and that might bring sensibility to the front of the table, to the front of the scene, and sort of keep the AOC plus three camp at the back of the Democratic backbenching system. So the problem is that if the Republicans lose the runoff Senate races in Georgia, then they won't be in that position. If there's a tie also in the Senate, 50-50, then the Vice President Kamala Harris will get the tie-breaking vote. So, there, you know, for that situation to play out with the Republicans having a full majority in the Senate, they need to win in Georgia. And I think the gamble is, do we run in Georgia? But by the way, the reason there's a runoff is because the leading candidates who were Republicans were sitting on like 49% of the vote, but you have to get a full majority in order to avoid a runoff. So the Republican Party is by far the favorite, but for it to hold on to that, it's got to decide, how do we want to campaign in Georgia? Do we want to say the Democrats stole the election, therefore it's very important that we get the Senate, therefore everyone has to come and vote for us? Or do they want to say, you know, the Democrats have got some decent chaps, but they've got some really wild ideas, and you know, you already basically voted for this candidate to get 50%. Just do it again, and we'll get a Republican senator in there. And I think if they take the former gamble, they risk inflaming. They sort of put the risk at race. They put the race at risk. They've basically already won it on the strategy that they had before this idea of the election being stolen came into play. And I think adding that new element could make a lot of people very worried, especially swing voters who, like I said, were keen on Trump's policies, sort of up and down about his rhetoric, and now look at him leading a charge to discredit the entire Democratic system preemptively rather than as a consequence of investigation, that might flip people. So I think it's a very dangerous risk. To Hadaman's point, the Republican Party is not just one man. They're going to be making that decision somewhat in concert and somewhat potentially against each other. It'll be interesting to see if there is faction fighting. But yeah, the first place to test that out, how are they going to play this out, is going to be in the Georgia runoff election, which I think is billed right for January, early January, late December, something like that.
Yeah, around the time actually.
I think the 5th of January.
Yeah, a little bit before then. Okay, so I think there's very likely to be significant factional fighting within the Republican Party, but probably also within the Democratic Party. And actually, to that point, my third question to you, Gabriel, was very briefly, what did you make of Joe Biden's sort of victory speech?
Very frustrating that he decided to thank his voters by race. I think that Joe Biden is sort of, he's kind of two characters. The one character is this sort of poor guy who to live a very honorable life, had a beautiful, he got in the ashes, did it again, more tragedy, got up and did it again. Ruthless, tenacious, honorable, courageous, hardworking guy who loves his country and wants to do the best he can for the poor. The other Joe Biden is this guy who says that if you don't vote for me, you're not black, who says in his victory speech, basically, thank you to white people, thank you to Hispanic people, but especially thank you to black people. You're the guys who got Biden did worse amongst black voters than the Democrat candidate usually does for a serious number of elections that better than the Republican candidates. So it's actually a weird thing to say. Of course, the majority of voters, black voters, the trends are going against it. That might be why he's saying it. I don't think it bodes well for the president to be going in with such an overt social identity thing. He says, no more red states, blue states. It's just the United States of America. And at the same time, thank you to voters by the color of their skin. I think this is a worrying sign because the thing to really watch out for is that Joe Biden is old enough and experienced enough to know that he's going to have to delegate a lot. And so the question is going to be, who is he going to appoint to key positions? And there just are American politicians in the Democratic system and in their sort of circle of influence outside of politics, narrowly in big business and so on, that very much do see the world through a racial cookie-cutting prism. And I think they tend to have more counterproductive policies that end up hurting the people that they nominally aim to help, policies that end up driving up factionalism or real fighting across America. At the same time, there's this other Joe Biden who, you know, understands that most Black Americans, for example, do not want to defund the police, do not stand for most of the policies of Black Lives Matter. But at the Institute of Race Relations, I think race is a very important issue. I think it's a very important issue in American politics. And the victory speech was conciliatory in most senses, but I think divisive in terms of race, and that's going to be a problem.
All right, Herman, final thought on this topic before we move on.
Yeah, I must say, I think I'm not one of those people to buy into, ageism. I think ageism more than anything else in terms of identity actually might often have some stereotypical merit to it. I mean, young people are more dynamic and more radical, and old people are wiser. I mean, this is essentially visible in studies on neuroplasticity and so on. But the thing that I'm really intrigued by, the fact that Joe Biden is a president from another era. He was first elected to the Senate 5 years after the death of Martin Luther King Jr. I mean, it was America pre-Reagan, and it was America pre-Carter. It was Nixon's America and Ford's America. And if you imagine the kind of the 70s movie sets that Biden walked around in when he was first elected, you do really realize that he's a creature from another era. Now, that does not mean he's discredited, but I think one thing that it does mean is that he's slightly caught between a rock and a hard place on race issues. He is the senator that, you know, spoke about Obama in an incredibly patronizing way. You know, he speaks so well. At last, a Black candidate that you can – I can't remember what the exact quote was, but he speaks so well, you can introduce him to your friends. You know, there was this real – paternalistic racism that might not have been out of place in the 1970s. But then you also – so it went from race matters a lot in the 70s and 60s because, it was just after the 60s, the civil rights movement, and there was this weird Southern benevolence almost from a paternalistic Democratic Party. And Joe Biden's idea of, Obama, he speaks so well – might have been, you know, not uncomfortable in that Democratic Party. Never mind wrong. It might have actually been a laudable position to not hate Black people, but only to look down on them and smile. But now you have a situation, and then there was this gap where sort of not really defined politics as much as it had. I think we have now more racially defined politics than any time since the 60s. And now Biden, again a creature of a different era, faces a circumstance where talking about race is absolutely required if you're going to, you know, be politically relevant. And I think his instinct on which America is he facing as an old man, as a candidate from a different generation, as a creature of a different Democratic Party, I think that is the source for his kind of cringe-inducing remarks, where he thinks it's both necessary and appropriate to thank by race and to think that that is really the way how to ingratiate yourself non-racially. Well, That's a very broad take, but I think there might be something to chew on there.
Indeed, and we shall see how his presidency shapes up when he appoints his cabinet, which I believe will probably be around March. Right, let's move on to our next topic for today, and this is regarding the Minister of Public Works, Patricia DeLille. Some, of course, her department was responsible for publishing the draft expropriation bill, which would allow expropriation without compensation of property. And the IRR wrote some heavy, strong critiques of this, and we went on to publish an alternative expropriation bill, which would protect property rights above all. Patricia de Lille has hit back, saying that essentially our alternative is, well, she implies that it's mad. She starts off with a quote in an op-ed she writes, about how doing the same thing over and over again, expecting a different result, is the definition of insanity. She says, the Institute of Race Relations has developed an alternative bill, forgetting that rehashing ideas doesn't mean they will be relevant to our present day situation or that those ideas will be accurate. She goes on to say that 67% of land in South Africa is privately owned, which, quote, until 1994 was owned almost exclusively by whites, according to the 2017 land audit report by the Department of Rural Development and Land Reform. While this has changed substantially, it is time that South Africans clearly understood the need to reverse the apartheid-era land dispossession. She goes on to talk about how the department had hired two advocates, Badlenda and Naidu, to respond to the IRR's alternative view. They found that the current piece of legislation the government has proposed simply makes explicit what is implicit in Section 25 of the Constitution. And the lawyers that the department hired to criticize the IRR's bill in 2015 say, in our view, the IRR draft is inconsistent with the approach to property which is reflected in the Constitution. So, let me start with you, Herman. Is the minister correct in her attacks on our alternative bill?
No, most definitely not. If we're going to measure the legal abilities of Patricia de Lille against Dr. Anthea Jeffrey, I don't think it's much of a close contest. But the fact of the matter is that the issue that de Lille raised politically is that this is an issue of – she accuses us of firstly trying the same thing that hasn't worked before. Meanwhile, her own legislation is actually the thing that has given us the last few years of uncertainty on property rights. And then she accuses us of populism when ANC internal polling indicates that land and property rights, or land specifically, is not a high priority for voters. And then it becomes clear from that analysis and looking at ANC ideology more broadly that they are actively whipping up through populism. They are whipping up this movement so that they can proceed in the style of the National Party of old and just interfere in the rights of South Africans to own what they've worked hard to earn. I've read Anthea's bill. It is a good bill. I mean, anyone who is familiar with Anthea's work would know that she goes above and beyond making sure that it aligns legally. And I just think that the fact that the minister is responding to the Institute on this is clear indication that she fears our input, because ultimately, if you're in a position of power, you only respond to those you think might cost you that power.
Gabriel, your response to the minister?
Yeah, so from like a slightly more playful point of view, she starts out by saying the definition of insanity is doing the same thing over and over again and expecting a different result. And then she attributes that quote to Albert Einstein. If you Google it, you'll find like a Business Insider piece among several others, but the Business Insider one is pretty funny, from 2012, which says that quote doesn't come from Einstein, and repeatedly saying that it does is possibly a sign of insanity. This is sort of an inconsequential data point where the minister is getting it wrong factually. There are others where she, for example, the claim that the land audit, the government's land audit of 2017, shows that white people overwhelmingly own private land. That's not true. That survey found that 72% of South Africa's land cannot be racially classified. There are
the remaining percentage can be classified as individually owned, and then you can find the race of the person involved. But that was largely even done by surname sort of guesswork. So even there, it's a bit of a funny business. What is the thing that has not been tried in South Africa? You know, okay, so let's not keep trying the same thing over and over again and failing. For sure, we have been failing. It's not a priority issue for most people, but it's also not an issue that almost that you can find anyone who really says we've been doing it right. So how could we do things right in a way that starts by not doing the same thing we have been doing? Well, we could give title deeds to the 18 million plus South Africans who live on government-owned land, give them full control of the land that they live on, get them out from underneath the feudal boot of the ANC, which keeps them in a system of tutelage where they're not really taught how to farm, a system of vassalage where they're not really given the capacity to farm, and a system of basically serfdom where they can't sell, leverage, or move out or use their land in as an asset in any real way. We haven't tried that. Dalil's not about to try that. I think that her message to us was a minor but further indication of the fact that the ANC's eyes are not on the prize. They are not trying to make this thing work. What they're trying to do is actually giving South Africans the tools they need to uplift themselves from poverty, particularly South Africans in rural heartlands where unemployment is at its worst, where access to services is at its worst, and so on. Instead, what they seem to be trying to do over and again is to use the land issue as a political brush with which to tar their preferred sort of out other group, white monopoly capital, and thereby, you know, make it the case that the worse the ANC does, the more political capital it gets, because it can keep sort of blaming everything on apartheid right. and its new instantiation of white monopoly capital. I think it's very unfortunate. I just want to add that when I was a kid, Dalil was the first politician that I would have voted for as a teenager. I really thought the ID party was great. I liked how tough she was, and I particularly liked how practical she was. She just struck me as a very practical person who didn't want to play politics, who was results-oriented, solutions-oriented, and boy, have I learned a thing or two growing up, and it's very sad.
Indeed. Anyway, that's all the time we have for today, so thank you very much for listening, and we'll catch you tomorrow on The Daily French Show. Cheers, everyone.